It was really validating to hear a medical professional sort of explain to people in my life that what I was going through wasn't this like mysterious, invisible thing, that it's a real, researched, diagnosable illness that, you know, if you do a CT scan on someone with an OCD brain, it lights up differently than someone without an OCD brain. And it's real, it's tangible. And oftentimes mental health is seen as this like self, like just do some self-care and it's done, it's gone. But no, an illness is an illness. Just because you can't see it physically doesn't mean that it doesn't exist.
There's like a deeper meaning behind all of this. Like it's how you were raised, what you were taught, what you were conditioned to believe.
This is the Desi Condition.
What's up, Bondus? Welcome back to the Desi Condition. I'm your host, Tanushree, and we have a very special episode with a very special guest today. And I know I say that all the time, but it really is special because we're talking about OCD today, aka obsessive compulsive disorder, which amazingly we haven't yet covered on this podcast. So Vardhan is a singer artist who I met at Masala Mixtape, and he had a lot of songs about mental health, like anxiety, and just talking about all this stuff, being really raw and open about it. And I said, yeah, we need to get him on the Desi Condition ASAP. So thank you so much for being here. I'm very excited.
Yeah, of course. I was really happy to get that message because it's kind of an intersection of a lot of my interests. You know, I am South Asian and I do struggle with my mental health. So I just felt like it both of those things are important to me. So I'm glad to be here. And yeah, a lot of my music is, I'm a musician and an actor. And yes, a lot of my music is inspired by my struggles and my thoughts and my emotions and my feelings that have to do with, you know, dealing with OCD and the distress and anxiety caused by it.
So it wasn't until I reached out to you that I really started learning more about OCD. And some of what I learned was a little surprising, not surprising, but I guess enlightening for me. So I want to start with media depictions of OCD. So some of the things that I guess previous me would have associated with OCD is like unpredictable behavior, aggression, people who are untrustworthy. And then of course, like we've heard it in regular speech, right? People being like, oh, sorry, I'm so OCD just for being very organized or something. And then, I mean, I've been guilty of saying things like, oh my God, I have so much ADD right now. And like, sometimes it elicits a chuckle. And then I'm like, no, I actually do have ADD. And then it's kind of fun to see the reaction because I don't seem like someone who has ADD, right? Because I'm able to be productive. But that's the issue, right? Mental health looks different for everybody. And just because somebody with ADD or ADHD has a reputation for being unfocused and lazy doesn't mean that's actually true, right? So of course, today's episode is about obsessive compulsive disorder, not ADD, but I think my point still stands. Like the media depiction of OCD are often inaccurate. So what is your takeaway on how people see OCD versus your actual experience? Do you feel like any of that is accurate?
So I think my biggest problem with how OCD has come to exist just as a narrative, through pop culture and media is that I feel like it's not taken seriously. OCD is a super debilitating illness that can, you know, unfortunately ruin and in a lot of cases end lives. But I feel like it's constantly undermined and taken lightly because I feel like OCD is often depicted as a quirk more so than an illness. People associate OCD with people who are super organized or anal or super clean. And a lot of times people associate OCD like with people who are like fulfilling their goals, and they see OCD as like a positive thing that may be able to help them stay on top of their lives. And that's absolutely false. And as you said, mental illness looks different depending on, you know, whoever's, there's no one way to paint a picture of a mental illness. So I think stereotypes in general for any mental illness work against, you know, spreading awareness around it. So I definitely think that there is a lack of knowledge and understanding of what OCD actually is worldwide.
So quick disclaimer before I get into what OCD actually is.
We're not medical professionals. Neither of us are.
What we hope to do with this episode is just kind of scenario map Vardhan's story. Maybe you feel like you relate to him in some way, but if you have any idea that this might be something that you're struggling with or somebody that you know, please go see a medical professional. Hoping that maybe you feel a little more educated or maybe a little bit less alone after this episode. So I want to do a quick read of the definition of OCD from the Mayo Clinic. So obsessive compulsive disorder features a pattern of unwanted thoughts and fears or obsessions that lead you to do repetitive behaviors, which are called compulsions. So Vardhan, how did you realize that you have OCD?
I remember my first experience where, so I was diagnosed with OCD, you know, when I was well into college, but I think I was experiencing symptoms way before that, like even before high school or around high school. And I just didn't know. And going back to what we were just talking about, I didn't know that it was OCD because what I was going through and what I was feeling didn't really connect in my head as OCD, just because I was told, again, through pop culture and media, that OCD looked different. That, you know, I was like, I don't wash my hands that frequently. My room isn't super tidy or organized. So I was missing my symptoms. And I think this is a big problem because for people who are going through it and it's hell, like you're living through hell, but you have no idea that you even need to seek help just because you don't know any better. So people don't even seek help or treatment for OCD because oftentimes they don't know what the symptoms actually look like. So for me, it was a lot of intrusive images and really distressing thoughts and images that would pop up at the most vulnerable moments of my life and make me doubt every single thing I knew to be true. And a lot of things that I was really excited about that would be spoiled kind of just by a lot of, you know, doubts and again, intrusive thoughts. And in order to reassure myself, I would do mental rituals. So for OCD, I think a lot of people just assume that the rituals, AKA compulsions, would be physical. But in my case, they were mental, like a lot of mental list making, mental reviewing, self-reassurance, and just constant justification that took up a lot of mental space for me. And it was super exhausting to do all the time. And it started to affect my relationships. And I was just constantly doubting myself 24/7. And it was just a really, you know, horrible way to live.
So how is what you're describing different from very severe anxiety in your experience?
So again, it's just from my experience. OCD, I know, used to be classified as an anxiety disorder, much like generalized anxiety disorder. But I think not too long ago, actually quite recently, there was a decision made to no longer include it in as an anxiety disorder. And I think there are key differences. Again, I'm not a mental health professional, so can't speak to it technically or scientifically. But I know that OCD can often be feelings of those feelings of anxiety and distress can often be accompanied by disgust or guilt. And it's just more so than feeling anxious, because some people with OCD wouldn't even describe their symptoms as anxiety. It's more so just feeling down and disgusted and constantly exhausted and tired. And a lot of people describe feeling depression as a result of their OCD, which in my opinion is also different from anxiety. So I think that the fears and thoughts and concerns associated with OCD are often more irrational than those associated with generalized anxiety. Like if I was an anxious person, I may be anxious about a work presentation that I have to do tomorrow or a party that I have to go to later today. Whereas with OCD, your anxiety could be related to a concern that has nothing to do with your reality, like completely irrational. Like what if I killed someone yesterday and didn't know it? Like that could be a concern that someone with OCD would have, knowing full well that they didn't actually do that. But their OCD could still make themselves doubt something that is so factually true, but they would still need to do compulsions in order to alleviate the anxiety caused by that thought.
So you mentioned when we talked before the episode about some of these thoughts being categorized kind of as ego dystonic thoughts. What does that mean?
So ecodystonic thoughts are basically intrusive thoughts, images, sometimes can be impulses or sensations, feelings, and fears that pop up in your mind, again, against your will, that go against whatever it is that you believe in and whatever it is that is morally important to you. That's why they're referred to as ecodystonic, because mm-hmm. they're completely against your values. So, for example, if I am a super religious person, I may get blasphemous thoughts in my head intrusively because religion is something that's important to me. So I could be going to church and I could be getting, you know, like blasphemous words pop up in my head, or imagery of like, you know, something that goes against my religion, or looking like an image of God in a way that could be blasphemous or something. This is just an example, mm-hmm. obviously, but, if I'm a mother who has a newborn child that I really care about, I could have intrusive images of like dropping the child or harming the child in a certain way. And it's whatever it means a lot to you and whatever your values are, you will get, I've also read about how OCD is closely linked to Tourette's in a way where it's like against your will. It's just like things popping up in your head and creating severe anxiety because it's attacking your moral values and everything you know about yourself. So you constantly start to doubt why you're having these thoughts, what these thoughts could mean. And don't get me wrong, like most people will have intrusive thoughts. People without OCD also have intrusive thoughts. But for them, the thoughts are fleeting. Like a person without OCD may be standing in front of the, you know, on the subway platform and have a random thought, like, what if I jump right now? Mm-hmm. Like a random thought. They know they're not going to do it. They have no desire to do it. It's just a random thought. And they tell themselves, oh, that was weird. Whatever. Move on with your day. Mm-hmm. Someone with OCD pays very close attention to how their brain works. It's like you're constantly monitoring each thought with like a magnifying glass. So when you have a thought like that, it gets stuck. And you start fixating on the thought. And the more you fixate on it, the more frequently the thought pops up. You try to get rid of the thought, and you try to get rid of it by doing compulsions. And then it's actually a vicious cycle because your compulsions are just, you know, feeding the actual obsession, which is what's causing the intrusive thoughts. Hope that makes sense. I feel like I just talked in circles for a little bit. But
No, it makes sense. Actually, so what I was going to say is that this ego dystonic thoughts that you're describing, I can see why that would lead to having doubt and a lot of like doubt in who you are, your identity. Actually, you mentioned the word doubt, I think like 4 or 5 times already in the episode in the few minutes that we've been talking. And so my question for you is, how is OCD overlapped with your identity as a person then, and also as a queer person?
Yeah. So, I mean, OCD is referred to by many as the doubting disease. An analogy that I like to use to describe how that feels, you know, in a minor way, is looking at the sky and seeing that it's blue, yet doubting whether it's actually blue. So a lot of people with OCD, myself included, have had this. Like another example I could use is getting test results from a doctor and still doubting whether those test results are actually accurate, or locking the door and seeing that it's actually locked in front of you, but still doubting if it's actually locked or if someone could still break in. You know, it's or driving home after a long day and wondering if you accidentally ran somebody over, knowing that there was no evidence to point to the fact. So it's you're constantly doubting things that are irrational, but the OCD makes you feel like they're rational. And to answer your question about identity, I think that OCD viciously attacks anything and everything that is important to the sufferer. So if your identity is important to you, like me as a queer South Asian person who, you know, is vocal about those things, my identity is important to me. So of course, OCD will attack that and will make you doubt, like, is it actually important to you? Are you actually queer? And like, of course I know I'm queer, mm-hmm. but OCD will make you doubt the most basic things about yourself. And sometimes it'll make you like in the complete opposite direction, make you wonder if you are exactly the type of person that you hate. Like, for example, I'm reading an article about someone who murdered someone or raped someone. And the OCD can make you wonder, like, what if you're exactly like that? What if you're repressing, you know, your desires to actually be a serial killer? Like ridiculous things that are against everything that you're going for. But the OCD will make you think a lot. It's just your brain is constantly on. And you're constantly thinking, and it feels like you can't get away from it. Like there's no running away from it because it's followed me into my dreams. Like there was a time where my OCD was so bad that I would just want to fall asleep. And I would like take stuff to fall asleep early. And I remember I was performing compulsions and rituals in my dreams even.
Wow.
And I would wake up feeling really, really distressed about like, why did I have this dream? Like, why was my OCD affecting my dream? Was it my OCD or was it real? Like, that's something that a lot of OCD sufferers also go through, is like trying to identify whether their distress and anxiety is OCD or not. And then that in itself becomes its own obsession.
So this probably has a lot to do with a struggle for self-confidence as well, I assume.
That's a good question. I think that it has a lot to do with certainty.
Okay.
It has, like, OCD is basically attacks the discomfort that a sufferer has with uncertainty. Like, you do compulsions in order to land and be secure. People start using, me too, start using compulsions as a security blanket to make sure that everything is all right. And if you don't do the compulsions, nothing feels all right. But compulsions give you a false sense of security and certainty. And I say false sense because they're not actually doing anything. It's just like, it's almost like the chemistry in your brain, like it like alleviates the anxiety when you perform a certain behavioral action, but your reality is not actually changing. It just feels like it's changing because you feel like you're in control of things that may happen, things that may not happen. And that's why OCD also ventures into what we call magical thinking, in that a lot of times we feel like our thoughts dictate reality when in fact they don't. And that's actually made a little bit worse by the whole, like, you can manifest things into reality type rhetoric, which, like, I think works for a lot of people, but people with OCD actually are scared by it because we're constantly having these really terrifying thoughts and like thinking about terrifying things that may happen, or it feels like we might make them happen just by thinking about them. And therefore we do compulsions to undo those thoughts so that it's like neutralizing them. And then mm-hmm. I've had instances when my OCD was bad, it would be like, if you don't cross the street before the light changes, this person that you know and love may die, or, you know, you may fail at your exam tomorrow. Like, it'll just tell you things like that. And then you actually go, you have to do it, or else it feels like it actually might happen.
Mm. So can you speak to how does this affect your interpersonal relationships, like with your family or other loved ones?
I think pre-diagnosis, it was really, really affecting relationships, particularly romantic relationships, and also relationships with people who didn't know what was really going on with me. And I didn't even really know what was going on with me, so I couldn't really talk about it. So people would just think of me as an overthinker, or would tell me to think less, or just, I would just find myself getting absolutely distraught over, you know, a lot of things that now make sense to me. But I think it starts to, again, how I was talking about before, starts to affect anything in any, or anything you care about. So anytime I were to get invested in a romantic partner, let's say, the OCD would latch on to that and start like making me doubt every single thing about them, and like constantly make up theories about what they were like or what they might be doing. And none of it was rational. And I feel like it would manifest. I would just constantly be anxious with another person. And obviously it would like sabotage the actual relationship. But once OCD is identified and diagnosed and treated, I feel like you can start pinpointing, you get a better sense of when it's your OCD versus when it's reality. Like, you start to become more aware of how your brain works. Mm-hmm. So I think it has been better since, and I think obviously treatment has helped a lot, and, support from my family has meant a lot to me as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up family. That was going to be my next question. So you are in college-ish age, right? And you, or not currently, but when you were diagnosed, you were...
I was like, is that what you think?
It would be a good thing. I mean, Yeah. Okay. So you were in college when you were diagnosed. So you're finding out and hopefully things are starting to click from like your thinking patterns or your certain behaviors. Things are starting to click, like why I'm acting this way. And then you tell your family. How do you support family and loved ones in knowing how to
deal with being in a relationship with someone who has OCD?
So, I mean, my family definitely noticed, because OCD can start at a younger age, obviously, but it can gradually get worse as you grow older. I think it started to get a lot worse for me when I was in college and then I had graduated. And I was actually, through my college, was able to see a counselor who saw that it was not in her wheelhouse to treat this because, you know, she wasn't trained to be able to treat OCD. So she referred me to a different therapist who unfortunately gave me the wrong type of treatment for OCD. And that didn't help because talk therapy actually doesn't help with OCD. It may help a lot of other people with, you know, generalized anxiety or depression, but it doesn't help people with OCD because the fears and thoughts are not rational. So talking about them actually is irrelevant and doesn't help. You have to sort of get to like be solution oriented as opposed to like figuring out the root cause of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But when it got really, really, really bad and it was visible to my parents, like, you know, I was very depressed because I felt like there was no way out and I couldn't get away from it. And it was like constant, like living through a constant nightmare all the time. And like waking up, I would feel like was a struggle. And I'd go through the day and everything was taxing. I couldn't send text messages without needing to send multiple in a row. I couldn't walk out of my apartment, and put my second foot down until I had the right thought. I couldn't plug things in. Like it really got super, super debilitating and it was just exhausting all the time. And clearly people could tell, I was very good at hiding it too, but I think it affected my mood to a point where like people, they noticed, and my parents definitely encouraged me to get more help. Cause sometimes when you're that down on yourself, like you don't even feel motivated to even look for help. So the family support came in pretty organically and I'm grateful for that. And, I think it was helpful for me to start going to therapy and then also take my family with me. I think my parents accompanied me to maybe two or three sessions with like different doctors because they were concerned and they had a better sense of what OCD was. And it was really validating to hear a medical professional sort of explain to people in my life that what I was going through wasn't this like mysterious, invisible thing, that it's a real researched, diagnosable illness that, you know, if you do a CT scan on someone with an OCD brain, it lights up differently than someone without an OCD brain. And it's real, it's tangible. And oftentimes mental health is seen as this like self, like just do some self-care and it's done, it's gone. But no, an illness is an illness. Just because you can't see it physically doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. So that part was validating. And I remember my ex who I was seeing, I also took him to therapy with me because there are certain things that loved ones of someone suffering from OCD can be taught just as tools to help them through like a particularly bad OCD episode.
That's so interesting about the CT scan, how the brain lights up differently. Now I'm thinking about how would my brain look under a CT scan? How does the ADD brain look? Actually, I have no idea. I'm so curious about
I actually
the science
have
of it
seen,
now.
I've seen the OCD brain like scans versus someone without OCD just like online. And, you know, different like doctors have told me that in the past. I don't know very much about it. Obviously, I'm not a doctor. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's fascinating how our brains are just wired differently. And it makes sense, yeah. You know, we're all different with different
and it really proves that this is, I mean, we're saying mental, but it really proves that this is a physical disorder. I mean, your brain is part of your physical being, right? Self-care is fine for a daily basis, but it's not treatment. Treatment is different from self-care. And we really need treatment for our physical body.
Exactly. And the correct type of treatment, and we need access to treatment. I think something that breaks my heart is that so many people are suffering. And since I've been vocal about OCD and like interviews and stuff, I have had DMs like on Instagram and stuff from people who are like, what do I do? I'm having these issues. And, you know, of course you you try to help them, but I know for a fact that so many people, it's so hard for them to be able to find the right type of doctor to treat them, the right type of medication that works for them. And there's also so much stigma, and I feel like we just have so much work to do.
So I have a friend who has a thyroid disease, and she can't use self-care to fix her thyroid problem, right? She has to take thyroid medicine every day. She just has to do it. She has to do it. And or otherwise she won't die from her thyroid problem. It's not serious enough for that, but it will affect her daily life, you know? And that is what having a disorder is like. You just have to take medication for it sometimes. If you can manage it, great. But like most people can't.
I think that you're totally right. I think, why is it acceptable for people to take medicine for their physical ailments, but mm-hmm. not for anything mental? You know, there are plenty of like people who take medicine for, like, for example, if you're diabetic, like you need insulin, and it's just, I don't understand why the same standard isn't applied just by society to mental disorders.
Yeah. Well, CT scan, I think, is one way to show that, like, yeah, actually, this is a physical, even if you can't outwardly see it, it does exist.
Yeah, like if not enough serotonin is being produced, like that is a, you know, medical, right? Yeah.
That's a chemical issue, right?
100%.
It's a chemical issue. So upon reflecting after getting your diagnosis, now that you're like several years down the line, do you feel like the diagnosis explains certain behaviors from pre-diagnosis? Were there any like moments of clarity?
Oh, of course, for sure. I was constantly, you know, it's easy to just think of yourself as a neurotic person or anxious or reading too much into everything, but it all clicked for me because I remember I had this one instance where it was my dream to, you know, I went to college for acting. I went to NYU. And when I was, you know, living in Delhi, it was kind of a dream to go to that school. And I applied and I worked really, really hard. And I actually got in. And as soon as I got in and people were congratulating me and like really proud of me, and I was really excited, all of a sudden I started having these thoughts that I was like, wait, is it good? Is it good? And it's normal to have doubts, right? But it started taking over. I think with OCD in general, a lot of it is things that a lot of people have experienced, but it starts to become a problem when it starts to interfere with your daily life. Like I would have to do compulsions going online and triple checking all the time to make sure that it was a good school. Even though it had been my dream school for most of my teen life, I had to read other people's comments, ask other people for reassurance, try to get like other people excited in order to feel excited. And the same with, like, I think OCD latched onto my physical appearance a lot. I undergone a major transformation from ages like 14 to, you know, 19, 20, where I lost a bunch of weight, grew in height. And all of a sudden my OCD latched onto my physical appearance, constantly needing reassurance from others about how I looked, or looking at myself in the mirror, looking at pictures, analyzing them. And there is also great overlap between OCD and eating disorders, actually, which is, you know, a brain is a brain. Like disorders can overlap all the time and can coexist at the mm-hmm. same time. But I remember like a lot of my, like I would be absolutely distraught if one person said something negative about my physical appearance or what I was wearing. I would spend like, it would throw me into a spiral, and I would have to go through lists of every single person who's told me that this makes me sound self-centered, but I want people to know that it's coming from, you know, the place of a disorder where like I placed so much importance on my physical appearance to the point where like it was the most important thing to me. And like, I would constantly be needing validation and reassurance, or else it would feel like I was worth nothing. And then I would constantly have to do compulsions, like making lists in my mind of every person who had ever given me a compliment in order to undo the feeling that I was feeling from this one tiny comment that I got. And like, this is just like early stages, right? It got to be a lot worse as I grew older about a lot of other different things. Just random concerns that I would have images of bumps on my skin and I would feel like they would actually happen. And then I would have to like take a break and then think of my skin being completely, so like, again, appearance related, like STI related. There was a lot of different types of concerns that I had over the years, and they all seem trivial now that I've gotten treatment. But over the years, there have been countless number of types of obsessions, themes of obsessions that are kind of irrelevant at the end of the day, because OCD will latch onto whatever it is that is important to you in that moment. And that's why it looks so different for so many different people, but the actual symptoms of the thoughts and compulsions and the distress is universal across the board for everyone who suffers from OCD, no matter what the actual content of the obsessions is. The feeling is the same.
It's interesting that you mentioned there is an overlap, or sometimes there's like a coexistence between OCD and eating disorders. It's interesting because a lot of what you're saying, I feel like I can relate to in a way, even though I know that I don't have OCD, but I did have an eating disorder when I was a teenager. And so now I'm thinking like there's certain thoughts that I was having that kind of felt like I was just obsessed with, like my, like I couldn't stop. It wasn't quite OCD, but there was some level of obsession there that I couldn't.
It's interesting that you say that you couldn't stop, because that's what something that's so signature about OCD is, that it feels like you can't shake off the thoughts. You can't shake off the feeling until you...
I guess the analogous version of that would be like to binge and purge. Like I can't move on until I binge and purge.
Right. And... you know, and see, like for me, I am not someone who has been diagnosed with an eating disorder. I mean, there's definitely been times where we've needed to keep an eye on, you know, just what it means to have or a healthy relationship with your body and body image. And I think that, you know, in this day and age, 2022, the age of social media, it's harder than ever. And I think for me, like with OCD, what I was saying was that the you feel like you can't move on until you've performed this ritual, whether it's a mental ritual of making a list in your head or mental reviewing and like making, and until it feels right, it sometimes physically feels like your body doesn't allow you to move on. Like I've been hit by obsessions like while I'm in the middle of doing something and I have to stop whatever I'm doing and then do the compulsion. And until I perform the compulsion exactly correctly, I can't resume whatever I was doing. Like it feels like you're just like frozen in that moment. And it happens to me particularly a lot still actually while I'm watching something. Because if I'm watching a TV show or a movie that may trigger a random thought or an obsession, oftentimes I will have to pause the movie and then do the compulsion and then play the movie again. And there was a time where I couldn't watch a single episode of television without needing to pause like 10, 15 times in the middle just to do compulsions. And I've gotten really good at multitasking, doing mental rituals in my head while talking to other people. And they have no idea that I'm even doing it. But friends definitely notice when I get quiet and they don't know that I'm ritualizing. They just think that I'm being introspective or whatever. But my therapist says it's pretty common for people with OCD to be able to, like they're like high functioning and be able to hide it. And especially with mental rituals, because you don't have to do them physically. It's like you could be pretending to pay attention, but in your head, you're just doing all these rituals to make yourself feel better because you're feeling distressed. And the other person has no idea.
Yeah, I guess that would need to kind of come with the territory. If you want to be functional, you would have to come up with systems to seem functional, even if you're not really functioning at your best.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I like to think of it as, we use this analogy a lot in therapy. It's like, there is a bully that lives inside your head and it is constantly screaming and shouting obscenities and just talking down to you all the time. So you have two options. You can respond to the bully and engage and talk back and fight back, which makes the bully bigger, actually. Like, this is a metaphor for compulsions, where it's like you're talking back in order to quiet it down, but it's actually making it worse. Unfortunately, the only way to do it is to resist engaging, which sucks because the voice can get louder and louder. It can interfere with your life. It can feel super distressing and it feels horrible and uncomfortable. But the longer you can go without engaging, the quieter it'll get over time. And sometimes you even want to encourage it. Sometimes you want to be like, oh, is that all you've got? Cool. Like you're just a bigger person, but you don't want to respond. And the lack of response will quiet it down because your body will stop. Like, it's like your internal body, like, alarm system goes off every time the OCD is triggered, but you have to recalibrate that and make your body realize that it's a false alarm actually, and it doesn't deserve a response. Mm.
This is so interesting. So the people who are listening, I'm on this learning journey with you as well. So I'm learning things on the go as well. I think I did my homework, but you can't learn everything from just homework. And so much of what you're saying is like, I'm now relating back to the days of when I used to binge and purge. And it almost feels like kind of not, I mean, I'm still not saying that it is OCD, but something sounds similar. Because once I got past the body image issues, once I got past the eating disorder, like, I don't have these tendencies that you're talking about. But when I was bulimic, I feel like my brain kind of operated in that way. And the way to deal with it was to kind of disengage from that voice. Mm. So it's interesting. It's something that I'm going to like go and like research about later so I can...
I know, and I know there has been research done on the overlap between OCD and eating disorders. I think obviously, like, there's so many different types of illnesses that may have overlapping symptoms. So
yeah,
you know,
there's a lot of intersectionality just in mental health in general that it's always there. It's just like not something that's talked about enough because there isn't enough like maybe research on it or just people even talking about it.
No, like even if you look at like physical illnesses, like there's so many times when you could have a sore throat. It could be COVID. It could be strep throat. It could be the flu. Like there's so many different illnesses that have similar symptoms. And I feel that way about, mental illnesses as well. But then there are definite like defining symptoms that like sort of make doctors go like, oh yes, this is OCD. And the constant cycle mm-hmm. of obsessions and compulsions and unable to perform tasks and live your life without the inability. I was like, is inability a word? The inability to move on without doing the compulsion is a classic symptom of OCD, and the egodystonic obsessions are also, and the fear of doing something that you would never actually do.
I'm glad you clarified that. Did you have any misdiagnoses? I've heard of there being misdiagnoses, particularly with disorders like maybe bipolar is often misdiagnosed as a depression. Did that happen to you with OCD?
No, I mean, my symptoms were very clear to the doctors that I saw as OCD, and the amount of time that I was spending in a day ritualizing. Like, there was a time I was spending probably 6 to 8 hours a day ritualizing, and the types of rituals that I was doing were very, very clear too, because it was mental reviewing, seeking reassurance, mental list making, self-justifying, Googling things and looking for reassurance of things that I already knew to be true. All of these are like very, very common compulsions, and some common physical compulsions also include like checking and washing. And I think that's why the media portrayal of OCD has come to be the way that it is because people have the wrong idea of why the stereotypes of OCD exist. People think that people derive pleasure from having OCD and being organized. No, there is no pleasure to be derived from having OCD. It's just coming out of a place of distress, and the person who's doing all those quote unquote quirky activities is actually in a lot of pain.
Thank you for clarifying.
So people often
that.
Blame the person like, why are you so... Yeah. People often blame the person like, why are you so anal? Why are you like that? Like, why are you so sensitive? It's like, no, it's not their fault. They're in pain. They feel like unless they do these activities, unless they do things in a particular way, that it truly feels like there's this weight on them that they can't shake off unless they do those activities. So
as a musician, have your symptoms aided or detracted from your creative process? I know you have multiple songs about mental health. So can you talk about how OCD has shaped your musical style?
Yeah. So I don't like to say that I don't like to give OCD any credit because, you know, I am not my OCD. My OCD is a part of me, but I am so much bigger than that. But I will say that I have had a unique perspective on life because of it. You know, being a South Asian person, being a queer person with OCD, I feel like I have a story to share and I have things to say. So from that perspective, I do think that a lot of my writing has been inspired by my struggles, but I like to thank my music for that because I find writing and turning it into song, like taking the pain and turning it into something that can make people feel good through, you know, the type of music I make is super upbeat and super feel good and kind of easy breezy pop, which is also the kind of music I like to listen to. But there's something empowering and healing and therapeutic about drawing from the pain that I've gone through and turning it into song. So I am grateful that I have that outlet. But that being said, I think my OCD latches onto my work after it's done. Like, I think I've had several breakdowns on several different release days for my songs because all of a sudden I'm super, super like, there was a time when like I would send my songs to people before they would come out and then constantly read into each person's reaction. And then on the day that it would come out, a song that I was so excited about, OCD would completely ruin the release day for me because it would make me constantly just, no matter how many people told me they loved it, I would just be like, OCD would be like, they're lying. And then I would have to do compulsions about why it's actually good. And then all that mental work just made every release day super exhausting. So because why? Because the music is something I care about. So of course the OCD is going to latch onto it. But I think once you get prepared for it after treatment, I'm in a much better place where it's like I'm anticipating it and I can get ahead of it. And I'm like, I feel like I'm a lot more zen about it now.
So what does management look like for you?
So first of all, let me just give you a little spiel about my whole treatment journey. I was first, as I mentioned before, I saw a counselor at NYU and I was then referred to a psychologist who tried to treat it with talk therapy and it didn't do very much. And a year later or so, I saw a therapist who specialized in OCD in LA. And that was my first experience with exposure and response prevention. Exposure and response prevention is the gold standard treatment for OCD. What it means is that the OCD sufferer will expose themselves to their obsessive thoughts on purpose, and response prevention, which means that they will then not engage with the obsessive thoughts. They will be exposed to them, but not like engage with them and then not ritualize. So they won't respond. I know it sounds a little bit tricky to understand, but to explain it to a layman, it would be like it's like exposure therapy that you expose yourself to your fears. So if you have a fear of heights, you would go up on a rooftop and then look down. That was my first time trying that and it really did help. Unfortunately, I had to move back to India for visa issues and I saw a doctor there. And there are different types of treatments that work for OCD. There's ACT, which I'm forgetting what it stands for, but there's mindfulness. There's a lot of different things that you can do, but ERP, which is exposure and response prevention, is the gold standard treatment. And when I moved back to New York, when my OCD got really bad again, I enrolled in a study at Columbia University for patients with severe OCD, which essentially by enrolling in that study, I got free treatment. I was able to see a therapist twice a week for an hour and a half each session with a phone call in between. So it was pretty intensive. But at that point in my life, I needed it to be that intensive and I needed to go through several different evaluations to even get in. So all the other patients in the study were much like me. Also, you know, the OCD was severe. And that is how I met my current therapist. So doing exposure work with her over the last few years and finally having one person to talk to about all my OCD concerns and having one person who knows exactly how an OCD brain works was super helpful. And she helped me become more aware of how my brain works and how and what I can do, the tools that are at my disposal to be able to manage it. And now I still definitely suffer from OCD, but it's not I'm still living my life, and I'm not spending 6 to 8 hours of my day ritualizing. I can move on. Even when I have a distressing episode, it's temporary, and I can move on a lot faster than I used to be able to. And I'm super, super grateful for that, actually.
That's really interesting. Okay, so then what could that type of treatment look like for even just the writing process, like the writing and making of music?
So exposures are catered to what your OCD themes are. So if I have a fear that I may be a serial killer, okay, just an OCD egodystonic thought of like, I may be a serial killer. An exposure would be to watch a documentary about serial killers. And then it makes you really uncomfortable because the concept of a serial killer makes you really uncomfortable. And again, this is not true for me. This is just more of an example that I'm using. And for you to not respond to it and then turn off the movie and then go about your day. And then the more you start to do it, the more you start to realize that, oh, okay, this is just an OCD fear and has nothing to do with me. But for release day, I guess if my biggest fear is that the song is terrible. And my OCD will often be like, the song is terrible. And it's exactly like this other song that you hate. And your song and this song are the same. So an exposure that we did once was putting my song and that other song on the same playlist. And then playing them back to back and then not doing anything about it. Not responding, because the OCD gets triggered because you're like, it's seeing it on the same playlist. It's like super triggering. And it would cause a lot of distress. Like, and I would constantly fight the urge to do compulsions about like listening and differentiating how it's different and how it's better. Also, the problem with compulsions is the more you do them, the more you need to do them because they stop being good enough. Like if you keep telling yourself, oh, it's okay, it's okay. You stop, you believe it for a second, but next time you need more evidence to believe it. So a lot of people compare it to an addiction because it's never good enough. So, again, using an example, if I feel like I have germs on my hands that are causing me distress, I'll wash my hands once and I'll feel better. But then 2 seconds later, it'll be like, no, I didn't wash them well enough. So you wash them again, but this time washing them just once isn't enough. I'll have to do it twice in a row. The third time I have to do it three. So each time you do compulsions, it feels like you're spending more and more time each time because it's never good enough. It doesn't satisfy the OCD. Like you keep feeding it and it keeps getting bigger and it keeps asking for more. So yeah, the playlist exposure was a good one. And it's funny because exposures are so custom tailored to whoever the person is who's suffering from the OCD. But a lot of the contamination related obsessions are, you know, have textbook exposures like going to the bathroom and touching a toilet seat and then not being allowed to wash your hands for however many minutes after is an exposure for someone who has contamination concerns. If someone has checking compulsions or is afraid about like their door not being locked, like an exposure could be to purposely leave the door unlocked and then leave the house for, you know, so the exposures are tailor-made, but also like you have to do them safely. And usually you do them with a therapist, but the idea is to make your own anxiety spike on purpose and then not do anything to alleviate it until it goes down on its own. And then the next time it spikes, it won't feel as distressing. And it's basically like you're trying to develop a tolerance to the anxiety to the point where it stops feeling distressing.
It's kind of like immunotherapy. That's what I think about, because that's what I've been doing with, because I have like weird seasonal allergies. So I've been doing immunotherapy by like, they keep exposing me to the things that I'm allergic to. Which is a little less harrowing than what you're talking about.
Wait, I heard that parents will do that to kids where like they'll like give them dairy and peanuts at a young age so they don't develop an allergy.
Yeah, I've heard of parents doing that kind of stuff. So it's like for me, like none of my allergies are really like life-threatening allergies. They're more like sensitivities. So they like inject me with the things that I'm allergic to and it's supposed to help. I don't know. We'll see. It takes like 3 or 4 years for it to kick in. And hopefully I'll be less allergic to all the things I love, like nature and cats and dogs. the thing with the playlist that you described, comparing your song to another one, almost sounds like you have to like logic yourself out of having those particular compulsions by putting A next to B and saying, look at how different A is from B in X, Y, and Z ways.
So logicking yourself out of things is actually a compulsion in itself, we try not to do. Honestly, in some ways, the goal is to do nothing. The goal is to sit silently and let your brain talk to you, or let your OCD talk to you, and then do nothing. Like, my fear was that this song that I love and that I'm putting out is so closely, or my fear was that it's exactly like this other song that I hate. And I know that it wasn't, but I hate this other song and I hated the way it was produced. I hated the quality, and quality is super important to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to name the song. quality is super important to me. So obviously my OCD was like, your song is of the same caliber and quality as this other song that you dislike. So my impulse was to keep them as separate from each other as possible. But for OCD purposes, because it was such a fear and I was constantly trying to like talk back at the OCD being like, no, it's not. It's so different. Look, mine's so much better. Oh my gosh, look at the production. It's so much better. And like constantly trying to talk back to the OCD, and the OCD kept being like, no, it's actually exactly the same. How exactly is it different? And then I would have to go list how like exactly it was different. And the goal is to not logically differentiate them. The goal is to put them together on a playlist as an exposure and be like, you know what? Maybe they are the same. And that's, you know what? We'll see. And just moving on. And it's super distressing because you want to so badly be like, no, they're not the same. It's kind of like you're online talking to a troll on Facebook and they're like arguing against you about something that you know is false, you know, but you keep talking back at them and they keep coming back at you, and it keeps, you have to be the bigger person to just leave. And it's really distressing to leave. It feels like it's constantly pulling at you to come back.
Yeah, yeah. But, okay, that's really interesting. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, because logic is the enemy, you know, when it comes to... Mm-hmm. Because you can't argue with something as irrational as OCD. It's like talking to a wall. So logic is out the window because like... there's no use in arguing with logic because OCD doesn't listen to logic.
Right. Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Like there are people who struggle with severe OCD who have existential OCD where it's like they don't believe, they doubt whether they actually exist in the universe, or they doubt whether, you know, they're living in a dream. Like it's completely irrational obsessions that can kind of come in the way and take your life. So exposures have to be tailor-made to the person who, and you know, I think therapists are definitely so much better at coming up with exposures, but for me, like associating the two songs together was very anxiety provoking, so we did that as an exposure. Sometimes reading articles about things that can be triggering to your OCD are good exposures, which is weird because we live in a world where like trigger warnings exist, right? And for a lot of people, trigger warnings are super, super important. And, you know, but for people with OCD, in a safe environment with your therapist, the goal is to purposefully trigger your OCD. It's like you're constant with OCD. It's like you're constantly playing defense in your life. So if you play like the opposite of that, like if you play offense, then you get ahead of it the next time it tries to come for you. It's like you're going to the gym. Exposure therapy is kind of like going to the gym for your OCD. And it sucks and it's painful, but it makes you stronger in the long run. I feel like I'm using so many metaphors and analogies.
And metaphors are the best way for us to get it because I don't have OCD. So it's helpful for me.
I know. And also I do want to say that, you know, there's so much that it's going to be impossible to cover in an episode of a podcast. And I'm drawing from different experiences that I have had over the years, not necessarily in chronological order. And, you know, a lot from my memory that I remember, I kind of remember how it felt, but, you know, of course it was a lot worse in the moment and it wasn't yesterday. Cause I've been able to manage my OCD for the last couple of years and I'm grateful for that. But I encourage anyone listening to this to, if they're interested in learning more about it, to please go and look at the International OCD Foundation or even just read the Wikipedia page for OCD, because I feel like I mean, it would mean a lot to me, because even just one person learning more about it could then help spread awareness about it by telling other people about it.
Your experiences have been very enlightening for me. I feel like I've learned a lot. Of course, it's just your experiences. So, you know, we can't possibly know everything from one episode and, like, you know, the whatever X amount of hours of research I've done. But do you have any advice for people who suspect that they or someone they know might have OCD?
Yes, I do. I know how distressing OCD can feel and how hopeless you can feel while you're having a particularly bad OCD episode. And sometimes you're so in it that you don't even realize that it's an illness that's doing it to you. But in those moments, I just want anyone suffering from OCD to remember that there, not to sound cliche, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel, because I have also spoken to other people, you know, and I have met a lot of people online through the OCD community, like on Twitter and stuff. And I've seen so many people come so far and talk about their own journeys. And something that's been, you know, common in all of our journeys is that we all had a moment of like, oh, this is it. This is just horrible. It's never going to get better, and completely wanting to give up. But I promise you that this is a treatable illness. You just need to find the right treatment for it. And exposure and response prevention works. Cognitive behavioral therapy works. And once you find someone you can trust, who you can talk to about all your obsessive or like even the themes, because a lot of the times the themes are super hard to talk about if they're ego dystonic or taboo or whatever. If you find that safe space, you find the correct treatment, and you find a therapist you can trust, and if needed, medication, that you will be able to manage it and live your life to the fullest.
I like that message a lot. Yeah. Yeah. You are never the only person that's having symptoms of a certain problem that, you feel like you're having. I think, the rate in the US is something like 3-5% of people are affected by OCD, at least that are diagnosed. So help is out there, and also the science out there, the research is out there to back these treatment methods and medication if you end up doing that. Okay, so is there anything that I didn't ask you that you would like people to know?
I would just like to say that OCD has a very all or nothing, black and white mentality. It's very 100% or nothing, certainty or the worst thing in the world. I would say that it's been helpful for me to learn to live in the gray, and learning to embrace uncertainty even just every day, and being present focused and bringing myself back to the present moment has been super helpful for me. And, you know, we're all beautiful, nuanced, multifaceted people. We're not all one thing. And we don't need to be figuring things out as much. I think a problem with OCD is that you're constantly figuring things out or trying to get to the bottom of things in your head. And you feel like unless you figure it out and get to the bottom of it, that you're not going to be able to move on, because it's really, really uncomfortable. But sometimes living with that discomfort actually helps you get ahead of it, and the feelings of distress and anxiety go away and fade away on their own. So even if when you're doing exposures, if it feels impossible, if it feels super, super hard, it's just a reminder that you're actually able to do hard things, and that you're stronger than you actually are, and that you're able to face the uncertainty and live in the gray. That's what I wanted to say.
I love that. Thank you for that. I am so excited for you to be the next male Indian pop star, the next Hillary Duff, can I say, of our generation?
Oh my gosh, I forgot that you did some research about my Hillary Duff, you know, stan days. I was a huge, huge Hillary Duff fan, and I didn't realize that was information that was available so easily
it's
online,
available.
But it's a big part of my brand.
It was like
now.
The first thing that came up in like an article interview that you did. I was like, oh, okay, I can relate to this
man.
Oh
my gosh. I don't know. I think her album Metamorphosis was the first like CD that I bought or something, or one of the first CDs that I bought. And I just was like young enough where like I developed this like, I was like a huge stan, but I was just like, I was also at a very like impressionable age. But nowadays, a lot of people my age who I talk to are like, love her. A lot of people, I feel like she's a pretty well liked celebrity. So
yeah,
I chose the right one to become a fan of.
She's like one of those child stars that like, she's still likable even in her adulthood. She's incredible.
Exactly. So I feel proud of my like choice of like who I decided to become a fan of.
So how do we find you?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Vardhan Arora. I am also on TikTok, though I use that a little less frequently. But you can also search my name, Vardhan Arora, on there. And yeah, you can find me on Spotify and Apple Music, Vardhan Arora. And I hope you get to check out some of my music. And if you do, let me know what you think.
You were so good at Masala Mixtape.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited that performing live is the thing again after COVID.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to link all that stuff in the episode bio description so people will be able to find you. Thank you again so much for being on the show. It was so lovely to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was lovely to talk to you as well.
That is the end of our episode, Bondus. We hope you enjoyed this, and thank you so much for joining us on this journey. If you'd like to reach out to us, we can be found on Instagram and Facebook at The Desi Condition and on Twitter at TDCPodcast_. You can also email us at thedesicondition@gmail.com or visit our two websites, tdcpodcast.com and, of course, our Desi Creatives directory at desicollaborative.co. Stay safe, stay warm, make good choices. And we'll talk to you next time.